If you really want to understand critical race theory, you have to go back in time.
Their mission was to reestablish white domination, and they did that by monitoring every book in every classroom in the South.
From the African American Policy Forum, I'm your host, Kimberly Crenshaw. This is the United States of Amnesia, a miniseries explaining what CRT really is and what our reaction to it says about America's future. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
The 1992 Los Angeles uprising, the Cambodian genocide, Japanese-American incarceration. What you know isn't always the full story. Our new podcast, Inheriting, about Asian American and Pacific Islander families where the past is personal.
Korean Americans, we call it sa-i-gu.
Did you ever realize when you were a child that you became an orphan?
Camp was such a hard time. How do you think you got through it?
Listen to Inheriting from LAS Studios and the NPR Network. Wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Immigrantly. I am Sadia Khan. Our today's guest is Dr. Amra Al-Rais. She is an associate professor at Columbia University. Her work focuses on social cohesion, the process of radicalization, and how communities harm each other. She survived the Bosnian War and genocide in the 90s and wrote a book on her experiences as a 16-year-old surviving it. The book is called The Cat I Never Named, a true story of love, war, and survival. For those who don't know, the Bosnian genocide occurred between 1992 and 1995, involving severe ethnic cleansing, mass killings, and atrocities primarily against Bosniak Muslims by Bosnian Serb forces. The most horrific event was the Srebrenica massacre in July 1995, where over 8,000 Bosniak men and boys were killed. I'm so excited to speak with Dr. Amra today and talk about how to combat hatred and oppression in our culture. So without further ado, let's get started. Welcome to Immigrantly, Amra. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you for inviting me.
How is your heart today?
My heart? Oh, that's a complicated question. It's a heavy heart. It's a heavy heart. I think there's a lot of ugliness and pain and hate in the world. I work on prevention of hate and hate-fueled violence. And perhaps I'm more directly exposed to it, given my work, but it does feel at times overwhelming to think about how much suffering we are witnessing in the world. And for me, as a genocide survivor, as a Bosnian genocide survivor, it is very difficult to know that I, as one individual, cannot stop it all.
Why do you put that burden on yourself as an individual?
My husband often asks me, why do you think you have to do it all? I think some of it is survivor's guilt. When I came to the United States, I remember first moment when I saw all the lights from the plane, because I lived without electricity, access to food, to normal life for nearly 4 years, and looking down, and this was my first flight ever, how everything was lit and there was so much electricity that I have never seen in my life. I thought, wow, this is a land of possibilities. This is a land where I can achieve, there will be some space and place for me where I can achieve so much that I used to only dream about. And I always say dreams cost nothing. One of my biggest dreams has been to impact the world in a way that we have less hate. And so seeing hate on the rise in the United States and around the world, while I'm trying to do the best that I can to prevent it, to stop it, to end it, has been very, very difficult for me. And for better or worse, I put a lot of responsibility on myself that I do need to do my part to stop it.
Amra, for our listeners who may not know your story. Can you just give us a brief snapshot of sorts of your life before you came to the U.S.?
I grew up in former Yugoslavia, a country that no longer exists, that consisted of several independent states that came together in post-World War II Europe and formed a communist country, Bosnia and Herzegovina being one of those states. My hometown of Bihać is geographically situated on the border between Bosnia, only a few miles away from the border with Croatia. And it is known as a place that was occupied, attacked by many occupiers throughout history. It's sort of a line that in the imagery of many people, as they think of Europe, divides East and West. Romans occupied it, Ottomans occupied it, Austrians occupied it, Hungarians, Germans, and most recently, Serbian and Serb forces attempted to occupy it. In early 1990s, former Yugoslavia fell apart because one of those states wanted to dominate and did dominate the military, the economy, the political life. And Slobodan Milosevic, who was the leader of Serbia, proposed this idea of executing everyone who was non-Serb to create greater Serbia, to create a country that he perceived and his followers perceived as truly European, as cleansed of everyone who is racially and ethnically impure. And I was deemed in that narrative to be ethnically and racially impure as someone who does not belong to the living, does not belong to Europe. And as a result, I, together with thousands of others in my hometown, lived under the siege, Serb and Serbian siege, for nearly 1,200 days, cut off from the rest of the world, being bombed every day, living under the threat of ending up in a rape camp or concentration camp. In terms of my own personal life, I grew up in a family that was very happy, filled with love. My mom is now a retired history and geography educator, so things that she couldn't teach me in, not me necessarily, but also her own students, the stories she couldn't tell in school, because in communism, there was a lot of censorship and there was no freedom of expression in the way that one would hope, particularly for Muslims. Muslims were deemed illegal for several decades after World War II. So my mom would tell me these stories by the fireplace at home or on the bank of the River Una and so on. My father had his mom, who survived World War II, and his four brothers, but his father died. He never located his grave. He was killed during World War II fighting fascists. So my father ended up in an orphanage because his mother couldn't feed all five of her sons. So my father, all the love that he never got to experience from his father because he was killed at the very end of the World War II, my father expressed that love towards me and my two brothers, my younger brother Dino and my older brother Amar. And all of these incredible characters in my life, my family members and my larger community, are present in all of my stories.
Talking about stories, Amra, you've written books. One is The Cat I Never Named, where you talk about Matsi. Matsi is cat in Bosnian, and how that cat saved you and your brother's life in Bosnia during the ethnic cleansing, during the occupation. Can you tell us a little bit about Matsi and how that stray cat saved your life?
I often refer to Matsi as a refugee cat because I think she came with refugees that entered my city of Bihać as Serbs were pushing population out of the villages and other towns that Serb forces overtook. And I always want to clarify that when I say Serb forces, Serbian forces, it doesn't necessarily mean everyone who is a Serb. We can never generalize, but the Serb forces that partook in genocidal killings would push the population and take over town by town. So at the very beginning of the war, because Bosnian Muslims had no way to defend themselves, we had no weapons, Serb forces overtook about 75-80% of the country. And Bihać was one of the very few towns that was not overtaken. And so a lot of refugees were coming in. This is spring of 1992. And my father and I found ourselves downtown in my hometown of Bihać one day. It was a beautiful day, and I encountered, alongside with my father, all of these refugees. And at the time, I really did not fully understand what was about to happen to all of us. And I won't tell the full story, but I encountered several tanks, Serb forces that were in the city and had a very scary experience. And as I survived it, stepped away from it, this cat showed up. This cat showed up out of nowhere and really calmed me down. And I have to admit that I did not like animals with claws at the time. I'm very honest about it, because when I was very little, I was about 5 or 6 years of age, one of my uncles had a German Shepherd, and I was playing outside, and I ended up sitting in his car, pretending to drive my uncle's car. And the dog misunderstood that I was taking over my uncle's spot. So he didn't like that. And it was not a pleasant experience of what happened next. And so after that, I didn't really feel comfortable around dogs in particular. And so never thought of a cat or a dog as a pet until Matsi showed up and calmed me down. And then she refused to leave.
Cats are assertive.
Yes, she knew what she wanted, and she didn't care. She didn't even care what my mom wanted. My mom is a very pragmatic person, and she knew that we had no food, that something terrible is about to happen. Obviously, that was not always explicitly communicated to me as a child, because she wanted to protect me from seeing the reality that came our way, whether my parents liked it or not. Matsi adopted herself into our family and ultimately saved, as you mentioned, saved my life, my brother's life, and I think saved our lives multiple times throughout the war. And some of these stories are in The Cat I Never Named.
Amra, if you were to name Matsi, what would you name this cat?
You know, it's so interesting you asked me that question. You're asking me questions that so many people who have interviewed me over the years have never really asked me, starting from where's my heart today, which I think is such a profound question. And then this question, what would have I named her? Hope comes to mind. Mm. Love comes to mind. Resilience that comes to mind. I think I would have captured the beauty of her kindness and her soul in one of those terms.
How would you say that in your language?
Hope is nada.
Nada.
Love is ljubav. Resilience is otpornost.
Wow.
So probably nada. Or ljubav.
I love neither.
Get ready to embark on a culturally rich journey that will transport you to different corners of Italy through the voices of locals who make this country truly special. This is Italian for Sure, the podcast about Italian culture. Italian for Sure goes beyond the cliches and stereotypes to reveal the true Italian way of living. I'm your host, Katrin Scopertis, an American living in Italy. And I interview Italians who passionately share their wisdom, stories, and insights about Italian culture.
We usually do not use a spoon to eat spaghetti. And the worst thing you can do is to cut spaghetti. But I saw that, so.
That happens. Italian for Sure is perfect for listeners who dream of moving to Italy, plan on visiting or studying abroad in Italy, have Italian roots or heritage, or desire to learn more about the Italian culture. On this podcast, Italians set the record straight, allowing you to know what's Italian for sure and what's not. This is
Italian for Sure.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Looking to start a side hustle or become your own boss? Do it with Shopify. Whether you're selling succulents or stilettos, Shopify has the industry-leading tools to help you create, control, and grow your own business. So get serious about selling and get Shopify today. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.co.uk/special offer.
You know, I've listened to so many podcasts that you've been on, and you've talked about how, you know, there is no constructive use of hatred towards the people that have harmed you, including people who may have attacked your friends and family. But Amra, to me, how can one be constructive with those who are acting in such harmful ways? What does forgiveness look like to you?
You know, I didn't know if I forgave or came to terms with what I had survived. until I was asked as a graduate student at Columbia if I would lead a team that would evaluate a project that was focused on disarmament and demobilization and reintegration of the former soldiers in Bosnia post-war. So I was at the time asked to work with the International Organization for Migration through Columbia University and evaluate the success of reintegration of former soldiers post-war in Bosnia. And when I was asked by a faculty member at Columbia to lead this team, and she thought, well, Amr's Bosnian. I was a TA, teaching assistant at the time for statistics and quantitative methods. So I had the skill set to actually conduct an evaluation in terms of research methodologies. And then the knowledge of the language, the culture, very different for someone like me to go back to the region and evaluate the program than someone who's never been to the region. So the assumption was that those who worked with me could also, who were other students, graduate students, would learn a lot in working with me. And at the time, I asked if I could reserve the right to pull out of the project if I felt that I hated those people, if I felt that I didn't want to help them, couldn't help them, if I felt in any way uncomfortable, if I felt unsafe to be in the same space with soldiers who, you know, I was placed on a rape list. And talk about that moment when I learned that in The Cat I Never Named. And so now I was supposed to help these individuals. And it was difficult to imagine. The only way to know what my reaction would be was to actually face these individuals. I was too curious about myself to say no.
What about yourself?
Well, I just didn't know. I couldn't predict how I would react. I knew that I had so many different feelings and I thought, am I going to hate them back? Will I wish harm upon them? How could I possibly help them? Will I want to help them? Will I see them as a human being because they didn't see me as a human being? I mean, all these questions were questions that I was asking myself. And so when I ended up going back to Bosnia and I actually interviewed and surveyed and were in the same room, same space, talking to these people who knew I was Bosnian Muslim because of language that I spoke, because of my Muslim name. It was an experience in itself just to know that I am the one who now holds the power in a way to help them or not help them. And I think it was disorienting for so many of them because I was that object of hate. Now the object of hate is transformed not from someone who was voiceless and powerless in their target to someone who actually holds the power to hear their story and perhaps tell their story in a way that benefits them and their lives and their families. And that's the moment when I received a call from one of those soldiers who was hoping to get a cow and start a farm and begin to use livestock as a source of livelihood away from obviously military and killing. And he couldn't get it and get this cow. And he was really trying hard. And through this program, they failed to provide help to him. And I engaged and ensured that he received this cow that he really wanted. And this soldier called the office. I was in the office and someone told me, oh, it was in Sarajevo. And they said, there's one of the people that you had surveyed, interviewed, they're on the phone, and picked up the phone. And this man was just broke down and started crying and he was sobbing. And I was confused. And he said, I want to ask you, why did you help me? I said, I felt sorry for you. I actually felt sorry for him. And I wanted to help you. And he said, I don't understand with what I did to people like you. My nightmares have gotten worse now that you helped me.
Oh, wow.
Because I can't live with myself and I can't sleep. I can't function. And my help made it worse for him. That's the moment when I realized that one, I was void of hate. I felt there were times when during the genocide itself, and I write about it in The Cat I Never Named, I felt perhaps compelled to hate, to be angry, frustrated, and so on. And some of these scenes are in the book. But that was the moment when I recognized I lost capacity to hate. I don't have energy for it. I felt empathy for him. And for me, that was liberating.
Huh.
That I still had capacity to see a human in someone who dehumanized me so deeply. And I told him, that is your burden to carry, not mine.
That's so beautiful.
Have you seen the Real Madrid lineup?
Colin Bridgerton's back.
With the undead.
And it's all about the Iron Throne.
You have to watch it.
What's it on?
Bridgerton, Netflix.
The match is on TNT Sports.
House of the Dragon, only on Now.
Ugh, that's the one I don't have.
TV that flexes with what's trending? New EETV lets you add and remove subscriptions monthly. Search EETV today.
EETV requires EE broadband. 24-month contracts. Content may vary. Terms apply.
I know you've talked about this so many times in terms of building connection, building resilience to hate through connection. But as I was listening to your story on these various podcasts and through your book, how do you define that connection? Because in my mind, in Bosnia, people were living together. Bosnian Serbs and Muslim Bosnians were living together, right? There was connection. There were intermarriages. There were integrated families. And yet, in addition to the military, there was this silent majority or complicit majority that led that genocide. So what was missing in that connection?
Excellent question and really insightful observation. And actually, it points to the core concept, which I now teach and train educators and faith leaders and students and journalists and really anyone, any stakeholder in the society today in the U.S. and around the world. And it's this concept of educational displacement that I have been studying for years. It's this idea that we sometimes think if we put these diverse members of the community together, that we have created a community, but that does not necessarily, coming together in the shared space doesn't create the community.
Hmm.
We see that in the United States in terms of polarization and how people are increasingly feeling alienated in their own schools, in their own workplaces, in their own communities. And this sense of displacement that I talk about is feeling that even though you are sitting in that classroom, even though you're sitting in that birthday party or whatever environment, cocktail party you find yourself in, but you are feeling on the inside that you are not visible or that you are somehow disrespected relative to other people in the community.
Yeah.
And that's the phenomenon that we are not sufficiently talking about. And addressing that sense of displacement in our own spaces, in our own countries, in our own communities is what needs to happen if we're going to prevent hate and hate-fueled violence. Community isn't a society where one group feels and experiences privilege or feels superior to others, and the rest of the society has to accept that as a given structure. And that is what existed in former Yugoslavia. I never read a story that positively depicted Amra. I never solved a math problem that had Amra in it. And so I knew at the age of 7 or 8 or 9 that somehow I was lesser. That is not a community. That is not a connection.
And probably that lack of community or lack of empathy on the part of the dominant, self-proclaimed superior population also manifests in less guilt. Do you think that played a role in not just how Bosnian genocide happened, but also the world's lack of involvement to stop it, especially America's lack of involvement, right?
So let me start by saying this. A lot of people think of violence as the actual act of physically harming a person, taking their life away. I think of violence as a tree, or topology of violence as a tree. Roots to targeted violence, the kind of violence where a person is targeted for who they are, which is what happens in genocide. Roots to that violence is what's called cultural violence. And that's a term that originated with the sociologist Galtung, who's a father of peace education. Cultural violence is the narratives of racism, narratives of oppression, supremacy, marginalization, dehumanization. Those roots feed the trunk of the tree. The trunk of the tree for me is structural violence. Think of slavery.
Yeah.
Think of racial segregation in the United States. It's not possible for ordinary people, ordinary humans, to accept it as a norm, as a standard, to mistreat other human beings, unless we have provided a story that says it is okay. It is okay to do so.
Or we've created systems around it.
Correct. And so stories feed into systems, allow systems to be established. Once the systems exist, whether they exist in the United States or in Bosnia or anywhere else, those systems then make the actual direct violence possible. It is not possible for us as human beings to engage in mass executions and killings of other humans without having moral justification for it, without having a story that says it is actually okay because they in fact are not humans at all. And that's when we are able to disconnect our empathy. It's in fact, Bandura, a very well-known psychologist, talks about moral disengagement. Mm. This idea that you morally disengage from some parts of your community because you no longer see them as human beings. And in fact, you create a set of standards and morals that justify their execution. And that is what is necessary in order for people to partake in genocide.
Ara, how do you see that playing out in Palestine right now?
When you asked me, where's your heart today? That is where my heart is, because I am watching, like the rest of the world, every day, these images of children, young women, the way that I was, you know, 16, 17, without food, without water, cut off from the rest of the world. And the source of all that pain is exactly what we're talking about. It is this dehumanization. And it pains me. It pains me anytime I see the humanizing narratives targeting any one group of people, ethnic, racial, really on any basis of the identity, my heart falls apart. It makes me want to work more, to work harder, to try to stop killing. And that's where at times I feel helpless. Unfortunately, I wish I could stop all of that pain. I wish I had that power.
What do you think people like us, ordinary folks, can do for greater understanding of what's happening, especially in Palestine right now?
Read, educate yourselves.
But read what, Amrit? I was talking to one of my friends and she was like, oh, we should read scholars and experts. And I'm like, yeah, but scholars and experts have a lens that they see things through as well, right? Mm-hmm. So what do we read that's not tainted by somebody's own understanding of the narrative?
Let me say it this way. I think it's very difficult for people who survive awful, tragic atrocities to actually tell their story. I didn't sit down and write about my experience of surviving genocide in 1997 or 8 or 9 or even 2005 and so on. I was compelled to write The Cat I Never Named actually by witnessing the rise in hate in the United States. My first book came out in 2020, but the whole process started around 2016, actually election in the United States, where I saw this sort of escalation of hate-filled narratives and escalation of dehumanization. And I thought that I was, in a way, not failing in my obligations as a survivor to warn against the most extreme atrocities. And I sat down and started writing my story. And I knew that by sharing the most painful parts of myself with the world, that I could be targeted again. You know, one of the most painful aspects of being a genocide survivor is when your experience is denied. When my hunger, my home being bombed, my mom being to this day survived but deaf because our house was hit and she was closest to the explosion. When you know this is who you are and this is what your life was and is, and being denied that has been, I would say, the most painful aspects of living as a survivor of genocide, which is why it was important for me to write my story. And it's only once I actually had written it and had other people who read it, who said, I connected to what's happening in my country, around the world, people who have reached out, different backgrounds and experiences.
Yeah.
That's when I recognized that the greatest credibility ought to be recognized with the survivors, because it's actually not pleasurable to have conversations about these experiences. When one decides to say, this is what happened to me, and it's extremely painful experiences that we are retelling and telling over and over again, I certainly only do it because I am hopeful that it will benefit our society as a whole and people will learn from it and say, hate is not the pathway I wish to follow. So I would say, read accounts of those and hear those, actively listen to those who are sharing their painful stories, because it is not easy to do that.
And it's not somebody else's story to tell. It's their story when they feel comfortable, right?
That's correct. You know, in my stories, I, both in The Cat I Never Named and Three Summers, I actually integrate some of the Bosnian language, because growing up, that language was portrayed as somehow lesser, as if you were uneducated or if you were not to be offered credibility, you would be using that language. So there was a way to diminish the culture and the language and the food and so on. And so I actually intentionally decided to use Bosnian words, decided to name Bosnian things.
To own your language.
Correct. To own my language, because I actually never owned it. I never owned it in the way that celebrates it. And it's part of me.
Hmm.
And so survivor stories are the stories, to me, that are most educational, that matter. It's not the same. And I hold this intersectional identity of being a scholar and a researcher and author and a survivor, but there are not that many scholars in higher education institutions around the world who hold those multiple identities, who navigate, who can pool their lived experience and say, here's how it connects to theory and the research and so on. And so I would say, seek the voices of those who have those lived experiences that can educate you, because ultimately that is, to me, the most credible sort of source of origin of what it means to survive something as horrific as genocide.
Amra, part of your research, you're also looking at people who are radicalized through hate or educational displacement, right? Do you think it's okay for victims to hate their oppressors?
I'm never supportive of hate.
But it's a natural emotion.
Absolutely. I mean, and I, as I said earlier, it is something that I had moments. So just to tell you this one scene, this one moment where I took my guitar and I went to the attic of my house in Bosnia, because we were bombed by, we had no defense system against planes. And in fact, there was a, I think, flight embargo, but it didn't really matter to Serb forces. So they were bombing us. And so this plane that was bombing my street, my very own street, and I think there's still some bullet holes on the street that have never been fixed since that particular attack. This plane was flying very low because there was no danger of any defense system on the part of Bosnians to bring it down. And I took my guitar and, you know, I was a naive kid back then, teen, and I played music. I thought if this guy sees a young girl playing music to him, I was literally looking at the plane as he was going above my neighborhood. And I thought if he sees me, he's going to feel empathy. Instead, he, in my recollection, just intensified bombing my neighborhood. And in that moment, I realized I lost hope. And in that moment, I was very angry and I took my guitar and I threw it and broke my guitar and actually never picked it up again. I never played guitar again in my entire life. So I know what hate feels like. And I know that it can overtake you. There are moments when I was deeply depressed during the war because I thought hate surrounds me.
Mm-hmm.
Hate feeds this world and I am powerless to respond to it. Hate must be the answer. But in those moments, I felt exhausted. I felt I lost myself. I felt I wasn't me.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be that other person that I could have been. I didn't want to be a person consumed by hate. And I'll share one other moment when Serb forces were burning a hill across the river on the other side kind of my neighborhood. So my home is very close to the river. And my father and I were looking at how soldiers were coming down the hill across the river. And we could see the line of fire was getting closer and closer to us as they were setting homes on fire and killing people. My father turned to me and he said, "Amra, we are all going to be killed. This is it.
Mm.
This is the end. You need to know that you will likely be raped. But if you survive, there's one thing that no soldier can ever take away from you, and that is your education."
Mm.
So there were moments like that when I could have responded with hate. And luckily, my hometown was saved as Serb forces didn't get into my neighborhood. Otherwise, you and I would not be having this conversation.
Yeah.
It was that conversation and one of many that I had with my family members where I thought my resistance to this hate and my resilience to this hate will be education.
Mm.
For me to be the best version of myself, and will be for me to write my story, will be for me to come and show up and have this conversation with you to say, I don't hate. I don't want to become my haters. I want to end hate.
Hmm.
For me, that has been the best way to own who I am and not let hate or my experience of genocide define me.
Amra, that's a beautiful take. But that's you, as you said, right? I'm curious to know how, for some people, that hate translates eventually into radicalization. So people resisting something are called radicals, or they are deemed to be radicalized when they are just doing self-defense. So how do you define radicalization from that hate? And how are you seeing it occur, especially in the age of social media? And obviously to distinguish between self-defense and radicalization.
I have engaged in talking to people who have radicalized across different ideologies. So I look at radicalization agnostically. I think one of the mistakes that has often been made in policy circles, even with scholars, has been to link radicalization to identity, to actually criminalize identity. And that's something that, you know, especially sort of race and ethnicity have been criminalized in many contexts. As an example, Prevent program in the UK that was established years ago, in essence, profiled individuals who were Muslim. So a student reading a book on Islam could have been reported as potentially radicalizing when they're simply learning and reading.
Yeah, because Muslim identity is racialized, right?
Correct. I, in fact, am not preferential to the term Islamophobia because I don't think it captures fully the racist way in which Muslims are collectively treated in many contexts. And so I often talk about anti-Muslim racism instead of Islamophobia. But to go back to your question on how does that radicalization emerge, what I had learned over the years is the assumption that people who radicalize somehow are bad people, evil people. And even Bandura talks about this. We often assume that someone who commits an inhumane act of a violent act are somehow horrible people. But in reality, if you look through history, so many acts of genocide have been committed by ordinary people, people who were professors and teachers and doctors. And in the context of Bosnia, I often use an example of Biljana Plavšić, who was a university professor, who was Fulbright scholar in the United States, who argued in favor of Greater Serbia by suggesting that Muslims like me are lesser human beings on a biological basis and therefore do not belong to Europe. So my interest was to see, okay, all these people around the world resort ultimately to some form of violence to address their grievances. What is actually that process? Without judging, how can I actually learn from them? Because if I understand that process, then maybe I can develop training programs, which I now do for educators, for students, for other stakeholders to actually build what we call protective factors against hate. So you asked me about community building, building that sense of belonging is a protective factor. Because if I have a sense of belonging in my own community, I don't have to go online to build a community. If I go online, I am at risk of potentially being recruited by someone, whether it's recruited into ideology X or ideology Y. That is less of an interest to me because I think there are parallels across different groups. Most individuals who radicalized didn't say, oh, I radicalized because I wanted to kill someone from this particular ethnic or racial or religious group. They radicalized because they had a sense that somehow they were unheard, they were not seen, they were invisible, and they didn't see connection, feel connection within the environment that they were in. And so they also often have grievances, whether the grievances, you know, economic in nature or foreign policy in nature, they're grievances that then escalate their search for belonging. And how can they address these grievances? And so if we don't have nonviolent means to offer for someone to address their grievances, whatever those grievances are, then it is then natural for human being to seek an alternative option. It really begins with our social spaces, societal spaces, schools and universities, where people don't find a way to express themselves in the way that they wish.
Amra, beyond your work, what gives you hope on a personal level?
Young people really give me hope.
Yeah.
I think we underestimate the power of the new generation. I meet young kids as young as 8 and 9, you know, in some of my book talks, and they are so curious. And I think that the new generation is less constrained with the racial, ethnic, religious divides. I feel that they want to unify. They want to build a community. I think they're the ones who are going to really make the world a better place. I think, unfortunately, adults have failed some of these younger generations who are looking for a different world than what we are offering to them.
And in the end, Amra, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
Can I tell a story?
Yes.
So I'll tell you a story of when I fell in love with the United States of America. And it was the first time I arrived to the U.S. And I was waiting in the line, afraid that I was going to be sent back to Bosnia, that I didn't belong yet again. And when it was my turn to speak to the immigration officer, he was looking through my passport, my papers for a long time. And I thought, this is it. I don't belong. He's going to say, go back to the country that you came from. Instead, he reached through the opening, through the window, and he saw that I was shaking. So he saw that I was holding onto the counter, and he put his hand on the tips of my fingers and said, ma'am, welcome to the United States of America. I'm sorry for what happened to you. You're safe now. That's when I fell in love with America. I think that we have so many deep issues that remain unaddressed, but America to me is hope. It's an idea. It's an idea that it is possible to come from any part of the world and build yourself here. And I want to continue to believe in that possibility and work towards that place of opportunity for everybody.
It's so fascinating to me that it's hope for, as you said, so many people coming from different parts of the world, different ethnicities, racial backgrounds, religious identities, gender identities, and they still see hope in America, despite America's flaws, all the flaws that the U.S. has. We all see hope in it. We still do. Thank you, Amra. This was wonderful. Where can people find both your books? I have Three Summers. I'm reading it. I am obsessed with it. Is there a preferred bookstore, or would Amazon suffice?
Amazon or any other, really, Barnes & Noble, any other independent booksellers. I always say, if you have a little bookshop in your town, in your neighborhood, and you want to ask them to order the book, I always encourage people to support local businesses, but really anywhere online that they usually get all of their other goods, they can probably find both Three Summers and The Cat I Never Named.
Thank you, Amra. This was wonderful.
Thank you.
You know, I have interviewed almost 300 people. And when Amra defined the US, it just made my heart swell. I don't know why, but her story is one of the many stories that we ought to know, to understand, so that we can restore our faith in humanity and to see humanity in people around us. This episode was produced by me, written by Boba Kafshari and me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Hazik Ahmed Farid. The music for Immigrantly is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when we have another important story to tell.